Google Nate Noodlings, recorded on the 28th of August, 2021. This is my corner of the internet where I talk about the fun things that tickle my nerdy nerve endings. This is the 32nd grab-and-go size podcast, small enough to leave you unsatisfied and looking for something else. Coming up, progress on my new Cubicle Labs, Wayland on OpenSUSE Tumbleweed, Elementary OS Review, a bit of follow-up, my OpenSUSE Corner, and a computer history retrospective on lasers and computers. Settling to my new place and have mostly reassembled the bits from my super cubicle into this new studio room in my Cubicle Labs building. The nice thing about having a separate space from the house to do these things is that noise floor is a lot less. The downside is I have a chorus of crickets that tell me how boring I actually am. There's much to do yet in getting everything the way I would like. For starters, I've purchased a mini split air conditioning unit with a heat pump that's a bigger deal to install than I originally anticipated. It's going to require some surgery on the building, which I did anticipate, but also adding a dedicated circuit for this much-needed creature comfort item, which I did not originally anticipate. So I look forward to my continued work on getting my Cubicle Labs fully operational. There are many projects in the works that need to be completed. And also, you know, this is number 32, and to me, any power of two is an exciting thing. So yay for number 32. I became aware of this Wayland display server project back in 2012 when I was playing with this display link on OpenSUSE. I was told that when Wayland is released, within the next year or so, it would fix all of my display woes. Well, 9 years later, it was time to give it another try. I wanted to give Wayland an honest go with OpenSUSE again. The impetus behind this was mostly curiosity since it's in the news a lot, and I've heard so many good things about it. So when I used it, I had a few issues. Number one, the OBS Studio window capture that I use frequently on my live streams lacks cropping, so that just is not a good look for how I like to use it. Synergy or Q-Synergy barrier is not usable. I can't move my mouse from one computer to another and actually have it do anything on that other computer. It does connect, but nothing happens on the client computer, so that's kind of a no-go for me. The taskbar notifications for applications doesn't seem to work entirely. It doesn't have that orangish glow to it when something happens. That's not a huge deal. That's a real minor issue. The Yaquake drop-down terminal loses functionality. The big issue there is when I go to drop the terminal down, that works fine. But if I have it pinned and I click on another item, the Yaquake window doesn't stay above all the others, which is a problem. Also, if I don't have it pinned, it still acts as though it's pinned. Use the hotkey again to make it disappear before I can make it reappear. So it's a double tap on that. That by itself wouldn't be a big deal either. The middle click on my touchpad doesn't seem to work as well. I'm not sure. I tried to see if I could find the solution for that. I was unsuccessful. So kind of all those things, specifically the first two combined. But it's getting better. So my overall assessment, when I'm using my computer at home, where I actively use things like Synergy and Yaquake, I'm going to have to use X11 there. I suppose when I'm in a purely mobile state, not using Synergy or OBS, I can work around not having middle click, and the upshot would be I'd have some extra battery life. I'm very happy with the direction of Wayland, and I hope very soon all the applications I regularly use are going to be fully Wayland compatible so I can enjoy the visual performance benefits, fantastic new display server all the time. You can read the full article, of which I have a link in the show notes. I did a review on Elementary OS. It's been about a year and a half since I dipped my toes in spring-fed, constantly fresh, warm waters of Elementary OS. Elementary team continues to impress and really bring their best. You can see their design intent and user interface, and it's clearly focused. I want to give Elementary OS, the project, a lot of credit for their blog posts and release announcements. They do a fantastic job of informing users on what's going on with their project. Their latest announcement paints a great picture of version 6.0 called Odin. Quick stats that are, you know, important to me. It's running Linux kernel 5.11.0. It's built on top of Ubuntu 20.04, which means all the great work and tech from the Ubuntu community is at the core of Elementary OS. Bottom line, Elementary OS 6.0 is a nicely designed distribution that continually refines their user experience. Their recent addition of a dark theme has made using Elementary OS a lot more enjoyable for me and makes using it much better than it has historically. The addition of the quick selection for a highlight color makes Elementary OS a lot more my own. So from my perspective and personal requirements, Elementary OS is hitting a lot more of the marks than it had previously, but it still doesn't quite fit for me as well as plasma does. Now, it may be because I'm an old dog at this point, but I just happen to prefer plasma. A link to the full article will be in the show notes. For my Biddle follow-up, Biddle is like an online user group where we're set out to have a talk about tech around the virtual water cooler. Anything that is Linux, tech, and open source related is on the table for discussion. The big subject was, well, elementary OS. And many of the regulars were on the show. Eric Adams, again, graciously allowed the use of his Zoom account. It was a pretty decent turnout with a lot of great community discussion. Schickel was there to answer a lot of questions, especially about the direction and why the lack of system tray, which I respectfully disagree with the idea, but I like the concept and the direction that they're going of turning the task manager into also a system notifications tool, and then just eliminating the system tray, or rather keeping the system tray just for system level components like battery, network, power, so. But it was an upbeat, respectful, and all-around enjoyable conversation. I'll have a link to that show in the show notes. And I do want to thank Rocco for starting the Biddle community, which is where I felt like a member of the nicest group of people that were encouraging and uplifting and really helped me to grow and learn a lot. So you can feel free to be part of the show. It's most Saturday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, or UTC-4. For my OpenSUSE corner, this is the part of the show where I talk about my almost unhealthy obsession with the OpenSUSE project. I love the going-ons, and I just want to share some of my experience with you. So some smiles I got recently. I filed a bug against the versatile Commodore emulator where it wouldn't launch in Tumbleweed. Using the best of my bug reporting abilities, I created a bug on the bugzilla.opensuse.org, and within a couple days it was resolved, and now I can use Vice just as I had been previously. Everything is back to normal. Huge smile because the community is just so great. In OpenSUSE news, a couple of articles. One focused on Tumbleweed updates for Kismet, Pulse Audio, Python, and Thunderbird. Another article on the KDE gear and the frameworks update. Now, there were some issues with some build fails in the open build service. There was kind of it kind of caused some broken builds. Those builds were not released as a snapshot since it must pass the OpenSUSE's open QA testing. The size of the ISO media also became too large to fit on a DVD, so adjustments are made. And this frequently happens when the capacity exceeds the size. So those adjustments are made. The DVDs are pushed out and snapshots are flowing again. You can check out those details on news.opensuse.org. A link to that will be in my show notes. For my Tumbleweed roundup, now the scoring system seems to be still down. I'm going to rip through some of the changes that happened. Snapshot 0726 had updates in GNOME, IP Utilities, Xen, Yast, NFS Server. Snapshot 2021-0725, Node.js, some Python updates, more Yast modules updated as well. Snapshot 2021-0724, kernel update to 5.13.4, and Mozilla Thunderbird. For my computer history retrospective, an episode of Computer Chronicles on lasers and computers from 1984. This is my segment where I like to look back in time and see how the world of technology has advanced and how things have stayed the same. I find we often forget how far we've come and how good we have it today, while not always remembering how we got there. Having some historical perspective on computers and technology can help to drive some appreciation for all the hard work for what we have today. It's really interesting to see how a technology that is in some ways outmoded, lasers in computers, optical media, has had an impact on how we use computers today, the amount of storage that we expect, and how it really shaped gaming in the late 90s and early 2000s. This episode goes back to the beginning of lasers and computers for a look back of where it all started.
But laser storage is completely different. It starts with movies and it leads to computer-controlled video, right, once devices, and phenomenal storage densities for digital storage in a computer. It's my favorite subject right now.
Okay, we've got some spectacular examples of the marriage of laser discs and computers for you, looking at games, graphics, and data storage. First, let's take a look at the background, the technology of optical storage in this report.
About the only similarities between optical and magnetic storage discs are their shape and the fact that they both feature random access of data. But the big difference is just how much data can be stored on each side of a 12-inch laser disc, 1 billion bytes, or about 50 to 20,000 pages of text.
In 1984, a billion bytes, what, a gigabyte? That was a lot. Today, not so much.
Like the technique used to make phonograph records, a master disc is struck from which a series of plates are formed. These are the molds for making copies. While the image source can vary, the disc stores information by scanning it, much like a television camera. An image gateway compresses the picture and enhances it for retrieval. With a high-resolution monitor, an excellent image can be recalled from thousands in storage in about 8 seconds. The ubiquitous floppy disk is not yet an endangered species, but users might want to remember this. One 5-inch laser disk can store as much information as 2,000 floppies.
It is sort of funny to see that floppies are essentially an extinct species for modern computers, but, well, the retro community is keeping it alive, so maybe it's just endangered. And then Blu-ray discs today, which are the same size as a compact disc, so smaller than a Laserdisc, has 25 to 50 times the capacity of one Laserdisc from 1984. It is interesting now to see that the compact disc virtually non-existent on modern computers. I do have one in my server, I don't have in current machine or my laptop. The capacity of the compact disc got to 750 megabytes at its high end. Sometime in the 90s it became writable and then eventually rewritable. I still use compact discs, although increasingly rare, they still hold a special place in my heart. A lot of the big box games in the 90s came on compact disc. I kind of missed that method of software distribution, but only kind of.
Of course, you've talked a bit about the laser video disc player that can play movies. That's one of the components here, the system. The second part here is a microcomputer, which is currently marketed by Pioneer in Japan. It's a format referred to as MSX, which is a software and hardware standard that a number of Japanese manufacturers have adopted. The unique features of Pioneer's version, however, is that it has built into it not only a Z80 processor and a graphics processing chip, a keyboard, of course, and memory, a cartridge slot for plugging in game programs, but it also has a connector on the back which plugs directly into the video disc player. It's also taking video signals which come from the video disc player and combining the computer graphics and the video disc imagery on the screen. Right now, for example, the Sega logo and the Astron Belt, which is a game program we have running here, that imagery is coming from the video disc. The push button, push start button and so on is coming from the computer. It's a graphic overlay. And in fact, before we began talking here, we loaded the program which controls this game also from the video disc. It's on the Audio 2 channel in a format very similar to what other computers in the home would use an audio cassette.
So you don't have to have a read-only memory cartridge on this or a cassette or a floppy disk. The data comes right off of the disk itself. Right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So for distribution of games or conceivably educational programs and that kind of thing, you are able to bring in all of the things that one would normally have with a computer, the computer graphics and so on, but you can now also bring motion and still frame pictures that are full television quality and even combine those two.
The overlaying of computer graphics on video images, very cool for the time. I don't feel like it really holds up today. It's neat to see the experimentation of different manufacturers to utilize the technology. Obviously, it morphed with video cutscenes later on games in the 90s and so forth. But it's exciting to see how lasers ended up really revolutionizing the home computer market. This is 1984. Just at the very beginning of all this, when computer graphics were, well, not so impressive for home computers, but this allowed for great capacity and storage, much more rich content for video games. I highly recommend you go back and look at this episode of Computer Chronicles. It's a lot of fun to see how, it's neat to see how the industry was changing and new technologies were being implemented. This is a great episode to look back and really think about how these engineers impacted gaming even today. It's good to manage your expectations on the plans you create for your life. Sometimes things just take a little longer than expected. It also seems like you end up shaving the yak a lot more than expect. No matter the difficulties, you have to keep putting one foot in front of the other and continue with that ever steady march to your destination. But enjoy the ride. Be present. Don't just try and rush through it all. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this morsel of nerdy nonsense. If you have any corrections, comments, or addendums, feel free to send one of those fancy electronic messages to me at cubiclenate.com. If you'd like more of me in the world of podcasts, visit dlnextend.com, where I have a chat with my two superb co-hosts, Wendy and Matt, about the wonders and excitement in the Linux and open source world. Check it out on the Destination Linux Network. I'm also joined by Yannick, the French guy from Switzerland, with a podcast about making things called Maker's Corner Podcast at makerscorner.tech. This can be everything from building furniture, single board computer projects, to building things in software. So Maker's Corner bitalive.tech. More information on that. And also a live show, Bit Alive, most Saturdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. You can participate in Zoom or in the chat on YouTube. For more of my nonsense, visit cubiclenate.com. Use any method you'd like on that contact page. I'll get to it as quickly as I can. Until next time, see yous.
What may be the world's largest supercomputer center will be built at the NASA Ames Research Facility in Mountain View, California. NASA says the machines will be used to design spacecraft and study the universe. NASA officials say that within 2 years it will have supercomputers running 10 times faster than anything known today.